In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 30, Jesus concludes his teaching about entry into God's kingdom with a declaration that in God's economy, to quote him, many who are first will be last, and the last first. Many who are first will be last, and the last will be first. And I'm sure you will agree with me that that statement of Jesus about the kingdom and about entering the kingdom and about the fact that the first will be last and the last will be first is a deeply, deeply unsettling statement, especially if you are one of whom the world might consider to be the first, religiously or socially or whatever. It's certainly a statement that turns the world's way of thinking right on its head. And it's one that reminds us that when it comes to entering the kingdom of heaven, neither wealth nor power nor religious status or pedigree nor social status or pedigree counts for anything at all. And that's hard to believe. Even the disciples struggled with it when Jesus said, "How hard is it for the rich to enter the kingdom? Lord, how then can anybody be saved?" they said. It's hard to believe, and in my experience anyway, it's even harder to preach, especially if there are those in your audience, your congregation, who by the world's standards are the first. It's hard to say that, isn't it, in their hearing. When it comes to entering into the kingdom, according to Jesus, there is a great reversal. The first are last, and the last are first. In Amos 6, 1 to 7, the focus is not on entry and inclusion, but rather on exile and exclusion. It's the opposite picture. Not on salvation, but rather on judgment. But Amos's teaching is certainly no less unsettling than the teaching of Jesus. And if I may say so, perhaps even harder to preach. Can you see it? It's there in verse 1. In the word to the notable men of the land, the first among the first of the nations, the elite within the leading nation, if you like, the top 1%, in whatever category you want to put them. Can you see the word? It's there in the prominent position. It's there in the emphatic position. To the first of the land, to the great of the world, to the wise and the noble and the rich and the religious, the elite, God has one word. Do you see it? Woe. Woe to you. That's three words. Woe. 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 Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. Woe to you, teachers of the law. Woe, woe, woe. We hear it in the mouth of Amos, and it is echoed in the mouth of Jesus. And it's there in the simple statement of fact right at the end of our passage. For there Amos reminds us that though when it comes to inclusion in the kingdom, the first will be last, when it comes to judgment, what do we see? the first will be first. Therefore, they, you, will be the first into exile. You will be the first into hell. What an extraordinary thing. This then is the big idea of this particular section of our letter, of our book, of our prophecy. Sorry, not a letter. And as we look at it more closely, it's really important that we see a very significant corrective. Woe, for you will be first. Woe to you, the first of the land, for you will be first into judgment. What is the corrective? It's very important. When it comes to God's righteous judgment, whether it's exile under the hands of the Assyrians or the Babylonians, or that final, irrevocable, eternal exile, Jesus drawing on the language of the end of Isaiah to describe that exclusion for all eternity from the presence of God, in the language of Isaiah's exile picture, outside where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched, the very last words of Isaiah. As Jesus speaks about that final exile, as Amos speaks about the impending exile, what we need to see, and this is really, really, really important, especially in our current climate, is that the first are not first in the judgment because they are the first of the world. When he says the first will be first into the exile, it's actually not because of their privilege. It's actually not because of their wealth. It's actually not because of their religion. It's not because of their status. They aren't being judged because they are the first. They're being judged because of the kind of thing that being the first can so easily lead to. The first are judged not because they're first, but because of the way of life and the state of mind that often accompanies their status and their privilege. Neither wealth, nor power, nor social status, nor privilege are sins in and of themselves. If it were so, we would not have in Timothy, tell the rich of this world to be rich in good deeds. There would be, tell the rich of this world, sorry, you've got no chance. If it were so, it would not be how hard it is for the rich. It would be, it is utterly impossible and never any option. So what is the problem? It's not the firstness per se, but what firstness leads to. Just look at 6:1. What is so often the case for those who have great privilege and who are the first? Well, they are so easily at ease, aren't they? Privilege leads to presumption, overconfidence. I can get in anywhere. If you've got enough money, you pretty much can. So I can get into heaven. Actually, no, you can't. My money can get me out of anything. Therefore, on that day, it'll get me. No, it won't. No, it won't. No amount of money, no amount of privilege will actually protect you from wrath or guarantee salvation. So, though you have it, don't trust it. Don't presume upon it. But they were at ease, presumptuous, overconfident. How often a sense of privilege and entitlement can lead to the belief that somehow I'm special, I'm the exception to the rule. How often haven't you heard that? Look at 6:2. Pass over to Calneh and see, go from there to Hamath the Great, go down to Gath of the Philistines. See, are you any better than they? Really? But how easy it is to think that somehow God will make an exception with me. I mean, those people there, he'll deal with them all like that. But hey, I'm the exception to the rule. I'm special. Seriously? How often privilege and position causes people simply not to listen to counsel and to warning and not to take judgment seriously. 6:3. You put far away the day of disaster and bring near the seat of violence. Just don't take it seriously. Here's the warning. There's the preacher preaching week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, and the words fall to the ground. Dick Lucas tells the story of a man in the Ministry of Defense who worked in the city for I don't know however many years at the MOD, came after 20-something years to Dick, right at the end of it all, came to Dick to thank him for however many years of ministry and said, "Dick, I'm so grateful for all your preaching of the gospel, and I just want to say to you that I absolutely agree with you. When it comes to these things, one must do one's best." So, endless amounts of real gospel preaching. But somehow, it's for that person there, it's for that person there, it's for them there, it's definitely for them there, and it must be for them there, but it ain't for me. Think back to where we were yesterday this time. Just reminding us of the fact that we are first in line. But how easy it is with privilege and opportunity to just assume that it can't be talking about me. Are you any better? No, you're not. How easy it is for the first to be exploitative of others. One of the things that astonishes me, bringing near the seat of violence, one of the things that astonishes me in my own country is how poorly the wealthy white community pay their domestic workers. As a rule, there are glorious exceptions. And I often think to myself, how in the great wide world do we think that is right? And I'm pretty sure that that's not just us. Those who have are often so tight-fisted. And those who don't have are often utterly dependent. Bring near the reign of terror. And so what we find is a way of life characterized not by repentance and humility and generosity, 6:4-6, but rather by self-indulgence without any regard to others. Does that sound familiar? Or is that just us in Cape Town? The historical context of the book highlights that self-indulgence, exploitative, you know, prosperity, lack of concern for the poor. I mean, this is the theme, the melody we've heard right through this book. It was one of the key reasons for the exile. The passage we've just done, I think we came up with a title for it. Don't let your eschatology or your church kill your ethics. The day of the Lord, it's not going to be good for you. But how easily eschatology can cause us not to let justice roll down. How easily we can spend our time singing rather than serving and loving our neighbor. Self-indulgence, no regard. Familiar? So for Israel, certainly where I come from, not much has changed. Those who consider themselves to be the first can easily end up living for themselves, intolerant of the warnings about God's judgment, presumptuous about their standing with God. No wonder Jesus says how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom. Only with difficulty. But it's not impossible. For man, utterly impossible. Your privilege, your status, your money, your righteousness, whatever it is, no way will it keep you out of hell. Never. And it won't get you into heaven. But thank God it's not impossible. What is impossible for us is still possible for God. And the grace of God can still reach the first. And so as Amos lands this hammer, drops this terrible blow of woe and of judgment and of warning and of declaration, you will be the first. In keeping with prophetic literature, it is actually, you will be the first unless. Not unless you sell all you have and give it all to the poor. Not in that sense. No, because just your sudden generosity is not going to save you. That's not what it is. No, unless there is genuine repentance. The word of woe that Amos proclaims, exposing sin and the warning of judgment, is, at least until the judgment falls, a word of appeal. An urgent cry to Israel, to the notable citizens, to turn around, return to the Lord, and so doing discover what generations before them, and thank God what generations after them, have discovered. That the Lord who threatens judgment is happy to relent if people will turn to him. Relenting is a wonderful word. It means turning. And as we turn to God and away from our priggish, presumptuous, self-righteous, privileged self-dependence, we discover that the God who was turned away from us, I mean, how extraordinary. When the wealthy and the great and the mighty and the wonderful and the religious, when they walk into town, the great conference speakers, whoever they are, when they walk in, everyone is turning towards them except God. Except God. He's got his back turned. But as they turn to him, he's quick to turn to them. And therein is the hope. It's not that God's grace and willingness to relent in the moment negates the final judgment. There is a finality to that. In the passage just earlier on, there was a funeral. Chapter 5, verse 1. We were taken forward in time and put at the edge of the grave. It's like Scrooge, isn't it? There you are, transported to the funeral, to the lament, to the coffin, to the death, to the absolute lack of hope, the darkness. It lies in the future. It's described as if it is already past. Not to say, sorry for you, you've got no chance, but to say, unless you turn, this is where you end up. It is appointed for you once to die and then to face the judgment. And if in that moment God is against you, no matter who you are, no matter what you have, no matter where you've bought yourself into, you have no chance. But it's not too late. It's there in 7:1-9, which we're actually going to look at tomorrow, and we don't want to spend too much time on it there, but it's just there. It's actually there. Someone brought it out in our group in that little hint. Unless. It may be. Do you see it in 5:15? Hate evil, love good. Establish justice in the gate. Stop living for yourself. Do the good. The way you seek the Lord is by seeking the good. It may be. Not it will never be. Because it may be, could become. It can be, could become. It will be. If the first will stop trusting in their firstness. Tell the rich of this world not to put their hope in wealth, but in God. The big problem about being first in culture, first in society, first in this, first in that, is that if we are not careful, we put our trust in ourselves. And brothers, ourselves will damn ourselves. So how do we respond? 6:1-7, it's unequivocal. You can eat and drink and be merry, but tomorrow you will die. And the judgment will find you out, just like those cows of Bashan who are the opposite of the same picture. God will hook you out with a fish hook. And if you go up to heaven or Sheol, wherever you go, you will not hide. He will find you. You will die. But there is still time. And as Amos preaches this hard message, this uncomfortable message, there's an appeal. There's still time. Who knows? Perhaps. What must you do? If you are one of the first, I have no idea, but if you are, become one of the last. How do you do that? Not as you might think, not as the world might think. Not but just by exchanging one set of privilege for another set of preference. Because the way we become the last is to put our trust in the one place where salvation is found. In Amos, it's in the Lord himself. And by the time the gospel rings out across our world, it is in the Lord himself who has appeared in person. Because for generations and centuries and eons, we have been so deaf to the prophets that eventually the Son came. And though ignoring him leads to well-deserved judgment, turning to him brings life.